From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Carla Kaplan is my guest. She's an educator and the author of several books, and her latest is Troublemaker, The Fierce, Unruly Life of Jessica Mitford. Carla Kaplan, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so I got a package in the mail from my friend, the book publicist, Lissa Warren, and I thought, oh, she sent me like four books, but then, no, it's just one book, Troublemaker, yeah. The Fierce, Unruly Life of Jessica Mitford by Carla Kaplan. And I'm glad it was big because, you know, by the time I got to the end, I didn't want it to end. It's just an amazing journey, and you really bring her to life on the page, which is fantastic. And I knew of Jessica Mitford because I saw her on the Dick Cavett Show, and I remember, you know, I knew, although I'd never read The American Way of Death. But a lot of people who I told, they said, "What are you reading?" I said, "I'm reading this book about Jessica Mitford." They go, "Who?" They didn't know who she was. And yeah. I wonder if that surprises you, a woman who's written this large volume about Jessica Mitford, that a lot of people had never heard of her.
It doesn't really surprise me. My British publisher, that's the British copy behind me, the blue one, which your listeners, of course, cannot see, has come up with what I think is a kind of wonderful and apt phrase for Jessica Mitford, who I have to call Decca, and who many of your Santa Cruz listeners will know as Decca. The phrase they have for her is that she was a neglected icon, or that she is now a neglected icon, which I think is sort of perfect, because she is iconic. And to those who knew her, were influenced by the way she fought fascism and authoritarianism, and by her spirits and her playfulness, or were influenced by her work, she is absolutely iconic. She's iconic as somebody who left privilege to be an activist. And yet, there are lots of people who, just like the friends of yours you mentioned, who don't know who she is. So I'm hoping to remedy that. I do think of all the six sisters who have had a great deal of attention directed to them, including the recent BritBox show Outrageous. I don't know if you happen to see that.
I haven't.
She is the least attended of all of them. And perhaps that's because the Mitfords are such an incredible phenomenon in England. A little less so here in the United States, but there are thousands of diehard Mitford fans who have read multiple biographies of all the other sisters, and there just haven't been as many books about Decca.
Well, had you met her? Have you ever met her?
I wish I had. It would have changed a lot for me. It's very difficult to write a biography of someone you have never met. Fortunately for me, there are over 200 audio and video tapes of Decca talking. I have all kinds of private tapes, audio tapes and videotapes of her at parties and with friends. So I've never had the privilege of meeting her personally. I interviewed almost 50 people for the book, all of whom knew her at different stages of their lives and different ages of their lives. From Congressman Jamie Raskin, who knew her when he was six.
Wow.
And on whom she had a profound influence on him at 6 years old, to lifelong friends like Marge France, who I was able to spend the day with. And I spent a day with her sister Debo, but I never got to meet her. And I was very conscious as I was writing this book that it was going to be read by dozens and dozens of people who knew her. Or were her family members, or were her children. So the pressure to try to get her right, at least my version of her, you can imagine was immense.
Well, I was delighted to see Marge France pop up in your book because I knew her. I went to UC Santa Cruz, and a lot of, I'm sure, people listening who did go to UC also knew her, and she was a delightful person, a wonderful person.
Yeah, she was absolutely extraordinary, incredibly generous to me. I was able to spend a full day with her and then stay in touch after, as she sent me additional materials and we emailed and, you know, we had back and forth. She was wonderful to me. And her archive, which I don't know if you know, has been given to Smith, to the Smith Library.
Oh, nice.
And as part of this book, I actually spent a few weeks living in Western Massachusetts and working with her archive at Smith, much of which was not directly in any way related to DECA or even things they did together or their time together. But I couldn't get out of the Marge France rabbit hole. Once I started working through her papers and her archive, her life was so extraordinary, and her political eye was so crystal clear that I became just absolutely enamored with her. And her archive is very rich, and I think uncatalogued still. So I'm sure that's changing, but I think it was uncatalogued when I worked with it.
Well, one thing that Marge Franz and her friend Jessica Mitford had in common, I found out from reading your book, is the love of singing. I once spent an evening with some other people, including Marge Franz, doing a sing-along. And she loved to sing. And Jessica Mitford...
Oh, what fun for you.
Yes, it was great. And Jessica Mitford sang and had a band. And that was kind of an
odd part.
Yes,
she actually, in the last years of her life, had a band, remarkably enough, Decca and the Decktones. There were two recordings. They are largely on cassette tape, so they're fairly rare. On the other hand, if somebody wants to Google or YouTube Jessica Mitford singing, there are some YouTube videos of her singing that are available. There's one from Decca and the Decktones. And there's an incredibly marvelous one, maybe two, depending on your luck. You know, these change day by day, right? What's out there. But there are a couple out there of her singing with Maya Angelou.
Oh, wow.
And in one of them, she and Maya, who she insistently called her sister, as Maya called Decca my sister, they refused to clarify for their befuddled interlocutors, who would look at them and think, well, you don't look very much alike, you know. And they would insist, no, this is my sister. You should hear us sing. And then they would launch into these songs. And their favorite was a kind of ridiculous English ballad called, I don't know if you've ever heard this one, called Right Said Fred. Mm. And Right Said Fred is a very funny English ballad about two furniture movers who don't like their job, so they're constantly stopping to have a cup of tea and talk. And the repeat line is, right, said Fred, or right, said Fred. And they warble this out at the top of their lungs. It's absolutely fantastic. And they also, there's a recording of the two of them doing the Grace Darling song. And the Grace Darling song was so important to Jessica Mitford that she wrote an entire book about the English heroine Grace Darling, who is the subject of the song. I will say to the Santa Cruz listeners, do not feel bad that you don't know Grace Darling. It's one of her least well-known books in the United States. It's also not very well-known in the UK, I have to say. It was an odd little book written at a period in her life when she was indulging herself in odd little books. She wrote a sort of semi-memoir, semi-biography of Philip Toynbee. And then she wrote this sort of biography of the heroine Grace Darling, who was reputed to have saved English sailors off the Farne Islands in an enormous storm when they were shipwrecked. She was a lighthouse keeper's daughter who was renowned for saving sailors. And rather an unusual person for Jessica Mitford, of all people, to write a book about. But she had grown up singing the Grace Darling song and loved it.
We're talking with Carla Kaplan. She's just written a biography of Jessica Mitford, the author of several books, and including The American Way of Death, probably her most famous. You were mentioning a minute ago that there's two dust covers that I can see on your shelf. I got the American one, which is a lovely book. It's great, and it's got this it mostly is her eyes, because the big red letters got to cover the rest of her face. But that British cover of her, I mean, she's been arrested and she's, it's a mugshot, essentially.
It's a mugshot. It's one of her arrests. It's one of her mugshots. And I believe it's the mugshot. I'm pretty certain that it's the mugshot that was associated with a kind of social experiment she did. And it was the social experiment which led to her book, Kind and Usual Punishment, which is a book many, many more people should know. It's such an important book. It's one of the very first American prison abolition books. It is possible, although I can't prove it, that it was Mitford who coined, or at least first put into wide use, the term abolitionism to talk about prison abolition. It's a remarkable book. And as she was becoming interested in questions of the prison industrial complex and American incarceration and the prison system, she participated in a week-long prison education workshop, I believe in Washington, D.C. And as part of that, she was arrested. She had her mugshot taken. I think this is that mugshot. She also spent a night overnight in solitary confinement. And it was her time in solitary confinement which led to her first long essay on imprisonment, which was about women. It was called Women in Cages. And after that essay, she pivoted to working on the incarceration of men, mostly Black men and mostly Black militants. Her daughter, Constancia, was living with James Forman, the famous SNCC activist who brokered the sort of arrangement and agreement between SNCC and the Panthers. And she was very afraid her son-in-law, her son Outlaw, was going to end up in prison. And she became very interested in the fate and the situation of Black militants throughout California who were imprisoned under something called the indeterminate sentence, which allowed prison officials to keep them essentially as long as they wanted. So it could be a life sentence, in spite of the fact that some of them had been arrested for the most minor kinds of infractions. And so I think that mugshot is associated with that workshop, although there were other mugshots and other arrests. There were quite a number of them. But it was that period that led to her book, Kind and Usual Punishment, which I hope more people become aware of. It remains a fantastic study.
Well, I'm interested. So, I mean, I could see that there's obviously a need for prison reform. That's like clear. But what if you abolish prisons, and what would you do? How would that work?
Well, that, you know, that is very much the question that people bring to abolitionists, right? Is how would that work? And you know, what happens to the people who seem dangerous? And the answer is that we would have to develop a culture of reform, a culture of treatment. It is the fact that the percentage of prisoners who pose any kind of physical danger to anyone is infinitesimally small. Most of the people who are in prison for drug crimes or for minor crimes. And it remains the case that there is essentially no evidence that the prison system works either to deter others from those kinds of minor crimes, infractions, theft, etc., or to discourage those who are in prison from repeating those crimes. It's simply a system that doesn't work. And what abolitionists would say, and I think they have a pretty strong argument, especially right now, is the prison system as we have it, which incarcerates everybody from, you know, the most minor offenders and the mentally ill to people who have committed what we really call serious crimes never touches those who have committed the most serious crimes. Now, you know, the obvious case right now are the murderers of Nicole Good and Alex Preddy, right? They're not even being investigated, let alone any chance that they would be imprisoned. But what abolitionists say and what Jessica Mitford said is if we look at the history of wars or any kind of violence, those who perpetrate that violence through policy, through governmental channels, they're never imprisoned. So, I mean, the system only works to put away certain kinds of people. So it would entail a complete rethinking of what counts as crime, who counts as a criminal, what we count as a social response. And for the most part, abolitionists look to those very few countries, mostly in Scandinavia, gee, what a surprise, right?
Yeah.
Where the response to crime is very different and is largely not a prison system. If it is true, as abolitionists say, that one in three young men of color will be swept up into the carceral system. If that's true, and I think it is, I think those statistics are pretty much true, then the problem is clearly with the carceral system, right? That it can't be. So the question we need to flip the question of, you know, who are we imprisoning for what? Who aren't we imprisoning and for what? People often give the example of rapists or murderers, very few of whom are ever convicted or go to prison. So, you know, of course we want to stop murder and rape and child abuse. That's, you know, of course we do. There's no question of that. Is the prison system stopping that? There's not a lot of evidence that it is.
Well, I don't know how long it took you to write this book. I mean, I know how long it took me to read it, but you've been talking about the, no, I love it. I don't want to dissuade anybody from picking it up, and they shouldn't. It's a fantastic book. But I know that it might have taken, I don't know, many, many years to write it. And you were talking about the rise of authoritarianism, and I think that that's one of the things that you want to speak to with your book, because it's something yes. that we're facing now. But could you feel that as you were writing the book, or is it just that they're blossoming at the same moment?
A little bit of both, and let me start by confessing that the book took me fully 10 years to write. And part of that was because she led an extraordinary life, and there were lots and lots of people to talk to who she impacted and influenced. Part of that was that I feel if you're going to write a biography of a writer, you have to read everything they've ever written. And I did, to my great pleasure. So there were hundreds of editorials and hundreds of essays. And she kept everything she ever wrote. So for everything she wrote, there were dozens of drafts. She was an incredibly hardworking, remarkably disciplined writer. And she was somebody who had a very playful spirit. So not everybody would know she was always somebody who always put in the 14-hour day. She got up very early. She got to her desk. And then she made phone calls instead of writing. Like many of us, she tried to put other things between her and the typewriter. But she did an enormous amount of writing. She was an autodidact. And I don't know if all your listeners know that about Decca. It was a sore point for her. She was never allowed to go to school. She was denied any formal education. So she taught herself. And she taught herself mostly by voracious reading and then listening to people who knew about things she was curious about. She was curious about almost everything. And so if I was going to write a chapter, say, about prisons and about her book in the context of the prison abolition movement, I felt I also had to know more than I did before I wrote the book on the prison abolition movement and so on. So like her, I followed her down many, many rabbit holes and research tunnels. She was an indefatigable researcher, an amazing researcher. And so I felt I had to do that justice myself and know something about the subjects that fascinated her. So I ended up reading a lot more about death, embalming, the funeral industry, yeah, caskets, mortuary management than I ever thought I possibly could.
Well, her book, The American Way of Death, but we're talking with Carla Kaplan, and she's just written a biography of Jessica Mitford. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. The American Way of Death was a kind of a muckraking book that shone a light on the Forest Lawn kind of funeral industry. And I think there was a movie that she had a hand in and that I remember fondly. Did that book make a difference? Are things better now in the funeral world?
Can I give the long answer to that by also talking about where the book came from?
Please.
And sort of how she came to write it? Because the story of its impact is even more remarkable, given the origins of the book. Mm. Jessica Mitford, when she published The American Way of Death in 1963, had written one other book, which she had published in 59 and in 60 in the US and the UK. And it was a memoir of her family called variously Hans and Rebels and Daughters and Rebels. And it's a wonderful, very funny, very sly, often sardonic, sometimes tender account of this eccentric British insular aristocratic right-wing family that she ran away from when she was 19. And it's both an account really of why she ran away from them, no sense of social justice, no curiosity, no interest in other people. She needed a bigger life. But it's also a sort of tender looking back at some of their peculiarities and their eccentricities, and particularly at her sisters, from whom she really got her love of language and wordplay and teasing and pranks and talking and all of that. And she came to write, so her second book, a very different kind of book, is The American Way of Death, which she co-wrote with Robert Truhaft. It was completely co-authored. At the very, very end, they found out the publisher didn't want to put both names on the book. The publisher thought, for marketing purposes, Jessica Mitford was a better author. And Bob Truhaft said, I don't care. I'm never going to write another book. As long as I live, you go ahead. Just put Decca's name on the book. Huh. But the way the book came to her was that Robert Truhaft, her husband, people's attorney, right at progressive left wing, one of the people's lawyers, was the lawyer for the Bay Area Memorial Society. Mm. And the Bay Area Memorial Society was the nation's second co-op association and organization for do-it-yourself and cheap funerals. The very first one was, I believe, in Seattle, Washington. And it was designed to keep people's union death benefits out of the grimy hands of undertakers. Because what would happen to people, if particularly if a loved one who was a union member died, is they would go in to make funeral arrangements. And let's say the death benefit came to $878.16. Huh, what a surprise. The funeral charge came to $878.18, exactly what the death benefit was. And Bob was always very upset by this, and he would come home with these stories, and he would come home with stories about the undertakers. And Decca was dismissive of it. She called it Bob's death obsession, his thing. She wasn't really interested until one day. One day, Bob Truhaft came home with a story about one of his clients. And like most of his clients in this area of his practice, it was a widow whose husband had been a union worker who had died. She had gone in to make funeral arrangements, and she really needed to hold back some of that death benefit. She didn't have enough money for groceries. She didn't have enough money to live on. She needed that death benefit. So she was trying to keep the funeral costs down. And he kept throwing things at her. You know, you have to have this kind of flower and this kind of service, and you have to put your husband, your loved one, in this kind of casket. And it was one of these caskets with the satin and the metal and the mahogany. And then and she said to the undertaker, could we possibly keep costs down? Could I put him in a simple wooden casket like that one? And she pointed at a simple wooden casket. And the undertaker said to a grieving widow, well, I can do that, lady, but I'll have to cut his feet off to fit him in.
Oh, my God.
Bob came home with this story, and Decca just immediately said, we have to write about this. That's it. I'm in, right? That was that story. She said, I'm in. And they started subscribing to all of the industry journals. So they knew the inside of the funeral industry. She started going to their conventions, usually incognito. And Jessica Mitford really honed the look of a kind of British housewife. She liked to, you know, be in that outfit with the black handbag and the polyester wash and wear suits and very little makeup and the pumps. And people didn't suspect her at the funeral industry convention. So she gathered up all kinds of material. She took endless notes. People gave her interviews. She said, "Oh dear, I'm writing a book about death. Would you talk to me?" You know, so of course they talked to her for 3 hours and spilled their trade secrets. So then she and Bob ended up with everything from the Inside Out and the American Way of Death, which they thought would only sell to Unitarians and people in memorial societies. They were hoping for sales of a couple thousand copies. The American Way of Death became an instant blockbuster runaway bestseller, partly because of what they revealed and partly because it's a book on death that is hold your gut, laugh out loud, funny. It's funny on every page. She skewers the undertakers in a way that's absolutely hysterical. And the book became enormously successful. It topped the bestseller list week after week after week after week. And it had a profound effect on American law. So it rewrote it. The book was responsible for the rewriting of all kinds of laws about what undertakers could and couldn't say. They used to tell everybody that embalming was a matter of law. Embalming was not a matter of law, that it, you know, it was necessary for the safety of it, did nothing that in fact corpses aren't particularly dangerous from a health perspective. They may be sort of grisly to think about that, but then they don't really pose a health hazard for the most part, although undertakers always said they did. And it had such a profound effect on the culture, on law around what undertakers could charge, what they could claim, what they couldn't change, what advertisers could then claim, how you could lie to the public, how you couldn't lie to the public, that it changed changed John F. Kennedy's funeral. Mm-hmm. So after Kennedy was assassinated, the Texas Undertaker placed him in one of these, you know, all metal copper sealed caskets, right, to preserve the body. And his brother had read Jessica Mitford's book.
Oh, wow.
Bobby Kennedy. It's the real Bobby Kennedy.
Yes.
Knew Jessica Mitford's book, mm-hmm. and he had his brother taken out of the metal casket and put in a simple wooden casket. And the reason John F. Kennedy was buried in a simple wooden casket was because of the American Way of Death.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
and what about today? I mean, the book is still in print. It's been in print this whole time, right?
It's never gone out of print since 1963 to now.
And is the funeral industry much different today?
So there were many changes in the law and many controls exerted so that they couldn't lie to consumers. And it helped to change consumer law. And people like Ralph Nader owe pretty much everything to Jessica Mitford because she was really, you know, the first fierce advocate for consumer rights and the American Way of Death. Over the decades, the funeral industry has managed to claw back not all, but many of its privileges. At the same time, the funeral industry now faces a green burial DIY movement across the country, which is directly to the credit of the memorial societies like Bay Area and Seattle, which now exist in every state in the country. There is a funeral memorial society, so that nobody has to be at the mercy of being fleeced by undertakers. Anybody can contact these memorial societies and ask how to do a cheap or DIY service. And there's a movement now for green burials from an ecological point of view, for simply putting bodies in shrouds or cardboard boxes and in the ground, no chemicals, no embalming, and And it's partly being promoted by people who point out, rightly, that it, you know, every practice of contending with the remains of the deceased poses environmental hazards. There is no practice that doesn't. And the argument is putting people simply in the ground without chemicals, boxes, all of that may pose the least environmental hazard of all. Mm. So the green burial movement, I think she remains iconic to most people who are in that movement. One of the things she did in the American Way of Death, and then the revised American Way of Death continued, is the book has a really weighty appendix, and it lists all the memorial societies of every state in the country and who to contact and all the different associations. She was always really interested in putting resources in other people's hands. Jessica Mitford was somebody who had a genius for finding the resources she needed, whether it was interview subjects or facts. She was just an incredible researcher who could always dig up the facts she needed, and she could always find people who would help her get at them. And she wanted to share that kind of skill set with her readers. So she often included appendices, resources, lists, people's phone numbers appear in the back of her books, published. You know, I'm not sure they were always, giving permission to do that, I'm not sure, but, you know, all kinds of information at the back of her books.
We're talking with Carla Kaplan. Now, I know you've written a lot of other books. I haven't read them, sorry to say. And I know that many of them seem to be about race and diversity. So how did that lead you to write about Jessica Mitford?
So it led directly, in a way, to write about Jessica Mitford. And there was just an enormous amount of luck in my getting to be Jessica Mitford's modern biographer. The book I had published prior to this, in 2012 and 2013, was a group biography called Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. And it was the story of a very unlikely group of white women in the 1920s and the beginning of the 1930s who looked at different places of rebellion, different sites of rebellion and resistance. And they looked at Greenwich Village and said, no. And they looked at the Left Bank of Paris and they said, no. And then for some reason, it was a very unlikely thing for them to do. They looked at Black Harlem, which was undergoing an artistic political explosion. And they said, I'm going to go be part of that movement. I'm going to be a part of the Black Harlem Renaissance. And sometimes they came with a few resources. Often they just came with their own interest or their fascination. Some of them were true anti-racists and some of them were primitivists who had a very simplified notion of blackness and gloried in their own ideas of blackness instead of truly trying to learn about it. They wanted to be allies in Black Harlem, but they went with little more than their good intentions and their fascination. And what they had to learn, which we all continue to learn every day today, is good intentions are never enough. We are never going to defeat a racist system with good intentions alone. And the white women of the Black Harlem Renaissance had some pretty difficult lessons in the limits of good intentions. Many of them were what I came to see as failed allies. They wanted to be allies and they didn't succeed. And I thought it was useful for people to look at why they didn't succeed and to look at sort of what their journey was. But I knew, even as I was writing the second chapter of that book, that I couldn't write another book about failed allies, that my next book had to be a book about a successful ally. So I was looking for someone who made a racial crossover and was effective, was not a failed ally, but was a successful ally. I was also looking to write a book about a woman activist who was fun and funny and people wanted to be around, because there's a myth out there that female activists are gray and grim and over earnest and always politically correct and nobody wants to be with them. And, oh, do we have to invite her to the dinner? You know, that's the sort of stereotype. Well, first of all, I think I'm pretty fun to be with and I'm a lifelong activist. But, you know, I think there's been lots of women activists who are fun to be with. So I was looking for one who would also have ideally been a writer who did important social justice writing. What I never imagined in a million years was that it would get to be Jessica Mitford. Because the truth is, in the history of American activism, I don't think we've ever had an activist both as effective as Decca and as fun to be with. Part of the reason she was so effective is everybody wanted to be around her. She was a hoot. She was full of energy. She always wanted to do things differently. She couldn't follow the rules. She was witty and interested in other people and had an irrepressible sense of humor and made resistance fun. Well, who wouldn't want to be in a room with her? My goodness, right? So she was the answer to something I had been looking for decades, but it was, you know, even better than I had expected because, again, I just don't think there's an activist as fun or as funny as Jessica Mitford. So she was somebody I was looking for without knowing it was going to be her.
Well, there's a sort of a Downton Abbey aspect of the early part of her life, and It's such an unusual, I'm just using that as the reference point that we all get from having watched that show. The idea that someone could start there and become a communist in Oakland, it's quite a journey.
Well, exactly. And you're quite right to cite Downton Abbey. Some of the stories in Downton are actually drawn from the Mitford family. Hmm. I've never seen anybody write about that. I don't know why. If I get a minute, I'll do it. But some of the stories that get told about some of the characters in Downton Abbey are pulled straight out of the family, and straight out of the Mitfords. They were even more Downton than Downton, which is to say, not that they were wealthier than that family. They were at least as land rich. I mean, hundreds of thousands of acres, just a crazy amount of land. They weren't particularly cash rich. But they were even more eccentric and they were much more insular. So one of the things that was really hard for Jessica Mitford about her family was their disinterest in the outside world. For her parents, that disinterest was actually a matter of principle. They called the outside world with a capital E elsewhere. And they pronounced themselves opposed to it, and they wouldn't let their daughters get to know anybody who wasn't a relative. And so the children were just incredibly isolated and insulated from the outside world. And they happened to have been six young women who were unbelievably smart and creative and energetic and filled with ambition. And they were denied any outlets. So they all kind of reached up into the air and pulled down imaginary futures for themselves. And most of them were in keeping with the aristocratic life that they knew. So even Nancy, the eldest, who became an incredibly successful novelist, was aware that there were women novelists in the aristocracy. That wasn't unheard of. But they all pulled down these lives for themselves. And two of her sisters pulled down the most horrific, reprehensible, tragic, awful lives for themselves imaginable and succeeded wildly at them. Diana married Oswald Mosley, the head of the British Fascist Party, lived out her life as an ardent fascist, went to her grave unrepentant and insistent that the Holocaust was the fault of the Jews. There are YouTube videos where you can listen to her say these terrible things, and then it gets worse. Decca's favorite sister was named Unity Valkyrie, conceived in Swastika, Canada. Wow. Can't make that up. And she pulled out of the air the idea that she wanted to become a Nazi. She went to Germany. She stalked Hitler, and she became his intimate. And when the war was declared, she put a pistol up to her temple and fired, and the bullet went through her head, lodged in the back of her skull, and she lived about 8 or 9 more years with very diminished capacities.
Who survives shooting themselves in the head?
The bullet went straight through. It damaged her, but it didn't kill her. And, you know, so Jessica Mitford grew up in this household of comfort, insularity, you know, separation from all the working class people, separation from everybody in her village, because everybody in the village worked for the family. There was nobody who lived in the villages who wasn't beholden to the family in some way. So, of course, she couldn't really communicate with any of them. And she also saw the kind of tragic consequences of that insularity. She saw how some of her most beloved sisters became completely under the sway of the worst ideas in the history of political ideas and gave their lives over to it. So she, you know, she had the Downton background, but she had the Downton background with a much more serious set of consequences. And she fled that when she was 19. She left with her second cousin, Esmond Romilly, Winston Churchill's nephew, and her second cousin to fight in the Spanish Civil War. And that was how she got away from her family.
Well, I think that I could be wrong. I don't know enough about it, but I think that the royal family in England then didn't. Their problem with Hitler was not anti-Semitism. I think that was something that they shared, right?
There was very strong British aristocratic support for fascism. Right up until the declaration of war, and in some cases after. The way fascism succeeds is that some people support it and other people don't resist it. You know, there's a trajectory here, which we're unfortunately witnessing again. The British aristocracy, you know, felt that British, for the most part, of course there were left-wing exceptions. There were left-wingers born to the British aristocracy. Not enough of them. That's why Jessica Mitford stands out so much. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, you know, they really supported authoritarianism and supported fascist ideas of reordering society and, you know, putting everything back the way it was supposed to be. And there were incredibly strong ties to the German fascists throughout British society, really up until the moment the war was declared. And so the story of Jessica Mitford's family with fascists on one side and a communist on the other is not unheard of. It's just that there were fewer British communists coming out of the aristocracy. But there was, as you're exactly right, there was very strong support for fascism. That's one of the reasons it was able to succeed.
So, knowing you now and hearing how you did a lot of research into every aspect of the background of all these things, you know a lot about the rise of fascism in the 1930s in Europe, and now we're looking at America and seeing similar things. So how scared are you about our current situation and what we need to do about it?
I try, following Jessica Mitford's model, I try to be less scared than enraged. Mm. So one of the things that was remarkable about Mitford, and this can partly be traced to being the child of the aristocracy, is she was a fearless person all her life. And she lived through terrible tragedies and she took extraordinary risks. And she ended up in some very difficult, precarious, threatening situations all her life. She was almost never scared. And her argument was always that we can't afford fear. That's what they want us to feel, because fear is disempowering and will disable our resistance. I try to follow her model, but I have to say that means every day I wake up and I push down the fear. And then I try to sort of embrace the rage instead, because everything I've read about the 1930s reminds me that the current administration is not operating in a vacuum. Project 2025 follows an established playbook, as many other people have been pointing out, for fascism that goes directly back to the 1930s. They know exactly what they're doing, and they have followed precisely the steps of Italian, Spanish, German fascism. You know, you go after universities first, you terrorize the resistance. You know, in fact, the murders in Minneapolis are part of that playbook, that you mow down protesters to try to scare other protesters. I think we're in a very, very terrifying situation. I'm sure, like me, you heard this, you know, attempt to seize all of the voter records in Georgia. There's been this endless talk about invoking the Insurrection Act, right? Invoking that, which would be a way to derail the next election. I think if we could have a free and fair election, enough people who voted for Trump have now turned against him, have seen that you cannot have a lunatic driving this bus, that, you know, this is not working. But there's lots of reason to be concerned about whether we will have fair and free elections over the next few years. And that terrifies me as much as the presence of ICE in our communities.
Yeah, what do you think the chances are that they will? I mean, there's 50 states, so it would be kind of hard to cancel the election, but I guess that might be what he's going for, right? To cause some kind of a conflict that he could declare a state of emergency in.
I think that's probably the most remote possibility, because it's so hard to do that. But there are all kinds of other ways to jerry-rig the outcome of an election, even in this country where elections have traditionally been quite clean. Yeah. And one of the things that has been coming out in the press is that we know that they have been investigating every single one of those methods very, very seriously. They have white papers on how to do just that, on how to influence and change the outcome of elections. So I'm incredibly worried. I was worried, after the first time he was elected. I was stunned and worried after the second, when everybody knew exactly what they were voting for. Yeah. I think, like many Americans, I naively underestimated the depth of racism, because I think we have to understand the election of Trump as a response to the election of Barack Obama. There's no other way to understand how we got here, right, than in part a racist backlash to the election of Barack Obama. And I think I underestimated. I think I underestimated how many pockets of insane white supremacy there were active still throughout the United States, and he's galvanized and grown every one of them now. So, I think we're at as much of an inflection point and danger point as we've ever been. I also think the left knows more than, the left is so smart. It has so much research at its fingertips. You know, the left is filled with people who have actually read all of Project 2025, a longer book than mine, cover to cover, you know, and actually who can talk much more sensibly than I can about the moment we're facing. And that gives me a lot of hope. You know, we're led by people who are historians and who are constitutional scholars. And that gives me a lot of hope. But it is a really dark moment. You know, thank goodness yesterday, you know, it was just vinegar, but Ilhan Omar was attacked, you know, and it just goes on. The violence is just daily.
I heard a comedian say he blames women for our current situation, because every time a woman runs for president, we get this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think America will ever have a woman president? And do you think, I mean, that seems to be the key to one of the key entry points for the right wing, is the fact that twice there was a woman candidate.
You know, I don't know. I think I was astounded. And again, I'm a feminist academic. I should have known better. But I was astounded by how much the conversation about Hillary Clinton was about this nonsense of likability. And I was also astounded by how many people of generally good opinion and good view got onto the she's not likable train, as if most of our presidential candidates have been likable. Who of them has been likable, except maybe Barack Obama? I mean, he may be the singular exception as a likable presidential candidate, and even a likability has never been what we have, you know, forwarded to run this country. And only in the case of Hillary Clinton did that become the single most important issue. And it taught us all something about the depths of misogyny, and the depths of misogyny even amongst liberals, because all kinds of liberals got on that likability train. But, you know, the truth is, in the case of Hillary Clinton, we have rarely had a presidential candidate as qualified as Hillary Clinton. There are lots of things about Hillary Clinton I do not like. There are lots of political positions she took that I felt were horrible mistakes and absolutely wrongheaded, and all kinds of wrong moves that I thought she made. But just on the sort of criteria of qualified to run for president, when have we ever had such a completely qualified candidate? Almost never. And people didn't talk about qualifications. They talked about likability. It was astounding to me. And it didn't give me a lot of hope that we're about to elect a woman.
A friend of mine last night had a little dinner party, and she said, well, I think a woman could be president, but not Kamala. She was annoying.
As if that's an issue. As if Kamala, again, the likability questions. First, I mean, I don't know why she was any more annoying than anybody else who runs for president. Yeah. I don't see that. You know, and in fact, I found her, you know, the opposite. I use the phrase, I'm speaking all the time. I try to get her inflection, right? You know, at that set of standards we apply to people of color, to people who come from the working class, and to women, that we never apply to white men. And, you know, we're all seeing it, of course, with Alex Preddy. It's really good that Preddy's murder is having the response, that people are up in arms. But, you know, how many black men were killed without this response, right? So if we sort of needed a lesson in American racism, Preddy is one of those lessons. If we needed a lesson in American misogyny, the response to Hillary Clinton, the most qualified candidate we've ever had, that's the lesson. So I'm not terribly hopeful that we're going to elect a woman. I'd love to be proven wrong. I'd love nothing more.
Well, your book, and it's a fabulous, wonderful book, and everybody should read it. It's doing really well. Your book has been all right. I know this, but I don't know it well enough to say it. It's a finalist for. Tell me.
Yeah, it's actually a finalist for both the National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography, and it is a finalist for the Pen America Bograd Weld Award in Biography.
Fantastic.
So, you know, that's a pretty good journey for a book about a communist. I'm pretty pleased. I think, you know, maybe the committees are responding to the message that DECA brings that I respond to most strongly, which is, you know, what we need to keep up our own resistance and to keep up the fight is to keep up our spirits and to keep up the spirits of everyone around us, that we can't afford to give in to despair. We can't afford to give in to depression. We have to. She fought by keeping up her spirits. That was the secret of Jessica Mitford. And that's what she did for everybody who ever knew her. She kept up the spirits of everyone around her. And I think this is a model we really need right now, because one thing we know is we're in this for the long haul, right? This is not going to be over soon, unfortunately. We are in this fight now for many years to come, and we're going to have to keep each other's spirits up for a long fight ahead of us. And Jessica Mitford is an example of how to do that.
Are you actively teaching now in the classroom?
I am. I teach at Northeastern University.
And how do your students respond? And have I assume you have assigned this book because, you know, then that way you can guarantee 25 more sales or something like that.
I have not assigned this book. I am of the view that it is a bit unseemly for professors to assign their own work.
Obviously.
So, in fact, I have not assigned Troublemaker. I'm teaching a course in the public humanities, and I'm so overly concerned with that protocol that I failed to invite my students to a public reading I was giving, and they were horrified. They said, "You have to invite us to everything. We need to know about this. This is public humanities. You've written a book about, you know, an activist, and it's out there in the world." The courses I tend to teach at Northeastern tend to attract students who, like me, are very concerned about the future of democracy, both capital D and small d. And right now I'm teaching a course in the public humanities about all of the ways in which scholars who do humanistic inquiry cannot just get their work to the public, that's the least of it, but can partner with the public, can collaborate with the public to say, what's the knowledge we need to produce together? So, you know, I would say that I'm learning as much from my students as they're learning from me, and it's a great group to get to talk to, and I'm very privileged that I get to teach those kinds of courses.
Do you have, Carla Kaplan, something on tap? What will you write next now that you've finished this 10-year opus?
Well, I'm doing two smaller books, much smaller than this, on Zora Neale Hurston. So I'm going back to doing some work on Zora Neale Hurston. The first trade book I ever published was a book of her letters and a biography of her life. It's been called an epistolary biography, sort of a biography through her correspondence. And I'm going to use that time while I'm working on the two Hurston books to think about what's next and to think about who else has a life story that I think we can all learn as much from as I learned from Jessica Mitford, who has truly changed my life and hopefully is out there changing and inspiring other people's lives. So I have to find somebody as exciting if I'm going to ever do this again.
This book is amazing. It's called Troublemaker, The Fierce, Unruly Life of Jessica Mitford. And the author, the brilliant Carla Kaplan, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.